Next up on This Week in Law, we've got an amazing show for you this week. We've got Derek Khanna, who's been working hard on cell phone unlocking once he got done drafting the copyright memo for the Republican Party. We're going to talk about all of that. Trevor Tim from EFF and the Freedom of Press Foundation is with us as well. Evan Brown and me, we're going to talk about drones, copyright reform, WikiLeaks, lots more next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell and Evan Brown, episode 201, recorded March 8th, 2013. My Little Droney. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by ShareFile by Citrix. Enhance your workflow. Send files of almost any size easily and securely with ShareFile. Try ShareFile today. For a 30-day free trial, go to ShareFile.com, click the radio microphone, and enter TWiL. And by LegalZoom. LegalZoom is not a law firm, but provides self-help services at your direction, such as affordable business and personal documents you can trust. Visit LegalZoom.com and use offer code TWiL to receive $10 off at checkout. Hi there, I'm Denise Howell, and I am so excited for today's episode of This Week in Law. We have some fabulous guests joining us today who are right on the cutting edge of some very important stuff happening out there. So without further ado, I will introduce the first of them, and that is Derek Khanna. Hello, Derek.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
It was wonderful to have you on. Derek has been a very, very busy guy. Derek, between all the activism you've been involved in and writing that you're doing and tweeting and basically getting the word out about copyright reform and most specifically recently cell phone unlocking. I don't know when you're sleeping. So thank you for foregoing sleep yet further and joining us here today.
Thanks for having me on.
It's wonderful to have you. Also joining us from EFF, repeat long time, love to have him back guest is Trevor Tim. Hello, Trevor.
Hey, how's it going? Thanks for having me back.
Wonderful to see you again. Trevor, too, has been busy and paying attention to lots of things and has a new gig in addition to EFF, the Freedom of Press Foundation, which we are going to talk about in more detail a bit later on. Also with us from Chicago, Illinois, my co-host, Evan Brown. Hello, Evan.
Hey, Denise. Happy Friday. Good to talk with you. And Derek, Trevor, it's nice to talk with you. Derek, nice to meet you. So looking forward to our conversation.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, let's start on the Derek side of things and go right into some important copyright issues.
You see the Tennessee shaped label that I was talking about last time?
Oh, I see what you mean. Yes, I didn't know you actually meant the shape of the state. I thought in Tennessee they had special labels that I should be on the look for.
Maybe they are. They're probably all shaped like Tennessee, like that.
Yeah, probably.
There you go. See?
Yes, got it. Yeah. Yeah. That was probably done intentionally by Franklin, don't you think?
Yeah.
We'll have to ask him. Let's start out and talk a bit about Derek's background for anyone who has not been following along quite as closely as we have. Derek has had an interesting several months here. Late last year, Derek was working for the Republican Study Committee, sort of a think tank of the Republican Party, which writes up studies and reports on various crucial issues and helps the members of Congress and the Senate, the Republican Party in general, think about those issues and helps them understand and get their arms around them. Derek wrote a report about copyright reform that the Republican Study Committee released. It was November of last year, Derek?
Yes, November 16th.
November 16th last year.
Yep.
And it was up briefly and it was very well received and people were thrilled to read it and liked what it had to say, some very intelligent things about issues that we talk about on the show all the time. But unfortunately, and you know, Derek, I'm sure if you have any light to shed on this, please do. But for reasons that are less than clear to me, at any rate, the report was pulled and disavowed. A sort of "oops, I'm sorry" message went up on the site for the Republican Study Committee that said we didn't properly vet this, and kind of went up by mistake, and so we're taking it down.
I'm going to have to dispute your characterization. They didn't actually disavow it. Yeah, they never disavowed the report. They said the report had been officially approved and had gone through the correct chain. And they actually put the report online. I actually didn't have the ability to put the report online. So they were the ones who put the report up.
Right. But in taking it down, I mean, was it just sort of a, oops, we changed our mind then?
Yeah, the statement they put out was that they hadn't got a full perspective from all their members before they put it up, which is an interesting perspective. It's not really an accurate statement. That's not really the policy of the Republican Study Committee.
Got it. So Derek could have been retained to continue working as a staffer for the Republican Study Committee, but has not been, and is a free agent these days. Have you landed anywhere in particular yet, Derek?
Well, I'm a Yale Law Visiting Fellow for this semester with the Information Society Project, so I'm focusing on a lot of research on copyright, but also obviously the activism on the cell phone unlocking issue.
Right, and you're writing for Forbes too, and The Atlantic.
Yeah. Yep, and National Review and a few other publications.
And getting interviewed not just by us, but by Ars Technica, The Huckabee Show, Reason TV. I'm seeing you everywhere these days, Derek.
Yeah, we're just trying to get the word out there and talk about technology reform. I think these are really important issues, obviously, to your listeners, and hopefully we can get it out there to some more mainstream audience.
Right. So more recently, in the last month or so, Derek and a friend, acquaintance, colleague of his, remind us who that is, the author of the cell phone unlocking petition?
Sina Conifar.
Sina Conifar put a petition on the whitehouse.gov petitions site, taking issue with the announcement in January that the exemption to the DMCA that did for a while allow people to unlock their cell phones that was not renewed in January, that was a bad mistake, and that we needed the White House to weigh in on this, and we needed to have more attention and scrutiny, and that unlocking your cell phone should not be a crime. And you guys got your 100,000 signatures, and you got a great response from the White House.
Yeah, that's exactly right. We got to 114,000 signatures. I wrote the first article on this for The Atlantic, the most ridiculous law of 2013 so far. And that article got over 1 million hits. So this is clearly an issue that has engaged and enraged a large amount of people. And we were very pleased to see the White House reverse course in about 32 days and change their mind and come out in favor of cell phone unlocking.
Yeah, it's wonderful. It definitely was a pretty definitive statement from the White House, had some suggestions for what might happen next, how we need narrowly tailored legislation or regulation to deal with this issue. Do you think that the White House needs to do anything further at this point, Derek?
Sure. So the White House's statement said that they support narrowly tailored solutions to fix this problem. They haven't actually put any legislation forward, although I've been running across Capitol Hill meeting with members of Congress and their staff, and we have a lot of bills going on right now. But the White House hasn't actually weighed in on what those reforms would look like. But I don't think a narrowly tailored solution is actually what's necessary here. We've identified that by default, large forms of technology are effectively banned without any overwhelming, compelling governmental interest. And so this is a real problem that affects more than just unlocking phones. It affects other technologies that have nothing to do with copyright in its traditional sense or anything to do with piracy. Technologies such as disability technology, accessibility services that will help persons who are blind or deaf be able to listen to movies or read books. There's no reason why those technologies should be considered contraband as well. So we would hope that Congress takes up this issue in a full-throated way rather than just checking the box.
Definitely. Trevor, this is something that has been high on EFF's agenda as well. I'm sure you were happy to see this, at least the petition, succeed.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we've been working on DMCA reform for years now. And as Derek knows, you know, the big problem with this bill and this situation is the Section 1201 of the DMCA, which basically outlaws circumvention technology, circumventing DRM or digital locks, basically anything that keeps a lock on your device that only allows you to use your device for certain activities and bans you from doing certain other things. And so, you know, it's basically illegal to circumvent these blocks even when you're not actually violating copyright, which is a real problem when we're talking about the right to own and free speech and so many different rights that normally when we think of things that we own that we take for granted. So seeing the White House come out for this this huge step in unlocking cell phones is a good sign. But I think, you know, obviously we need Congress to act because the Library of Congress has already said for the next 3 years that this is essentially going to be illegal. So hopefully we'll see some action soon.
Hey, Trevor, I'm hearing a bit of noise, I think, from your little iPhone headset rubbing on your collar. Is there a way to...
Yeah, I'll just kind of hold it.
There we go. It's just right up there next to your collar, I think, is the problem. Evan, so Derek kind of... We talked about this when the exemption expired back in January. And sort of decided, well, you know, unlike Derek, who had high hopes that maybe we can change this situation, I think, you know, our consensus on the show was... the Register of Copyrights is going to do what she's going to do, and there's not a whole lot you can do to affect that. And, well, you know, there are some pretty draconian penalties involved here if you unlock your phone, but no one's really going to get those penalties. I think Derek has some pretty good and poignant responses to that, especially in the wake of what we saw transpire with Aaron Swartz. So have you changed your mind at all, Evan?
I don't think so. I'm still on the lookout for some indication as to how big of a deal this really is, and perhaps even more importantly, how big of a deal it should be. I mean, I know Derek writes very passionately about it and, you know, makes some very good points about it. But I just wonder, you know, how many people in 1,000, you know, this, you know, having this right or this ability truly does affect. You know, at the same time, there is an interest in as blasphemous as it may sound, I mean, there truly is an interest in the providers and also the manufacturers to a certain extent to have these types of protections in place. And, you know, that does have its way of stirring innovation at a really high level. So, you know, I get where the arguments come from the way that it's bristly to have the certain exceptions to this circumvention liability that we enjoyed for at least a few years under the regulations of the Copyright Act be taken away. So I guess that's it, right off the bat for me. I don't really know how much energy in the whole general scheme of things what a reasonable person should be thinking about these things. But I'm open for data, and I'm open for arguments as to the larger applicability for in other contexts, like you were talking about, Derek, with the blind and others.
I think you hit on a good point about the reasonableness of all these rules, especially when it comes to the Library of Congress's exceptions. I mean, phone unlocking was legal for the last 3 years, and they just ruled it illegal. And now we can jailbreak our iPhones, but we can't jailbreak our iPads, even though they're essentially the same type of device. They're just a little bit bigger. So it seems like there's really no rhyme or reason to these rules, even if one thinks that they're the laws in place for a good reason.
Yes, and thanks for reminding us. It's the Librarian of Congress who has control over the exemptions and not the Register of Copyrights.
Sure, can I chime in here?
Please.
So I wanted to break it down for some of your users, from some of your listeners. I know most of them have probably listened to your show every week, as I do. But for those who haven't, I wanted to break down the unlocking issue and walk through it just a little bit for a second here. So unlocking is where you change the settings on your phone, which allows for you to pop out the SIM card and use it on another provider. And basically what that means is doing what you want with your own device. And it has very little to do with violating your contract, because you can unlock your phone after your contract has expired, or you could unlock your phone while you're still under contract. But when you go on international trips, you can buy a SIM card when you get off of the airplane. Hundreds of thousands of our soldiers, when they get deployed abroad, they have to unlock their phones to use it in theater when they don't have Verizon in Afghanistan, for example. So this is a very useful technique that, albeit may affect a small portion of the population, but in effect has a major impact upon our property rights if we actually own the device. So what actually happened here, I think, is quite a scandal, and that's why I think it's pretty important, which is the NTIA, which is a department which is within the Commerce Department, provided their recommendations to the Librarian of Congress. And the NTIA said that unlocking cell phones, this technology is actually important for the wireless market to function properly, and it's important for consumers. And what they found was, contrary to the wireless company's arguments, wireless companies actually don't allow for their customers to unlock their phones after their contract has expired all the time. The wireless companies say that they always allow for their customers to unlock their phones, but if it's a property right, you shouldn't have to ask for permission to begin with. But the NTIA's findings were that even after the contract had expired, they routinely said no. So with these recommendations, the major wireless companies, AT&T and Verizon, petitioned to remove the exception nonetheless, saying they want to make this activity illegal. And at the same time, the organization representing over 100 wireless carriers, the Competitive Carriers Association, they were petitioning to allow for unlocking. So again, the big players are against unlocking. The small players, over 100, are for unlocking, because they see it as a pro-competitive policy. And then the Copyright Office, the Librarian of Congress, decided to make this activity illegal, side with AT&T and Verizon, which in effect means if you unlock your phone, you could be criminally liable for up to 5 years in prison and $500,000 fine. So that's a pretty significant decision by the Librarian of Congress, and that's why it's incensed so many people. But the solution isn't merely to reverse the decision of the Librarian of Congress. The decision at this point should be to have a law that permanently legalizes this technology, to say the Department of Justice will never arrest somebody for unlocking their phone, because this has no concern of the federal government. This is a matter of contract law. And that seemed to be what the White House was saying and what members of Congress are saying today and what was heard across the internet.
And yeah, hasn't there been some attempted legislation in the past, maybe 07 or 08? I seem to remember somebody floating an amendment to the DMCA that would have made this, unlocking a phone, maybe jailbreaking at that point. I don't know if we talked about jailbreaking all that much, you know, pre-iPhone days. And also adding in permanent, hardwiring into the DMCA exceptions for getting at content on a DVD if you want to make a fair use of it. Am I remembering right that there have been some legislative attempts in the past, even years ago?
I think the last legislative attempts were actually quite a few years ago, so it may have been 2007, but there hasn't been anything in recent memory. And in fact, Congress almost never has held a oversight hearing on their intellectual property laws, or the DMCA. And it's a really outstanding fact that one of the enumerated powers in the Constitution is their ability to be involved in intellectual property, but yet they've had almost no oversight hearings on how that's actually working out in the private sector.
So I sort of see this as a continuum of the world that we're living in now, where if you unlock your phone, it is a crime and there are stiff penalties involved. And then in the middle is this realm where it's okay to unlock your phone. It's not a crime, but the carriers can still lock phones, and people who are really committed to unlocking or have special needs to unlock, they can still do it, and that's fine. So, whatever competitive advantage they think that they get by locking phones, they're still entitled to. Whatever convenience or other advantage that users get, they get too. And then at the far end of the continuum is the world where maybe carriers are barred from making phones locked, where all phones have to be unlocked and can be manipulated by users at will. So I kind of like putting everyone in the middle ground, if that's possible. That seems like the most reasonable way to go to me. Derek, how do we get there? Since the law, you know, although we've gotten attention to the issue, the law has not yet changed.
Sure. So it's a little bit more complicated than that. So far, no one's really calling for the most extreme. We're all kind of in the middle mm-hmm. here. But mm-hmm. there is a continuum within the middle, which is it going to be lawful for personal use, but illegal to develop the tools, traffic the tools, sell the tools, mm-hmm. or even to discuss how the tools would operate? And that's what exists today on the books, unless you address that issue as well. So all those issues need to be addressed in legislation that's going to fix this problem. So on Monday night, we heard from Jason Chaffetz, congressman from Utah, that he's working on legislation. We still haven't seen that, but it's supposed to come out perhaps next week. On Tuesday, we heard Wyden introduce legislation, and that legislation is very narrowly focused. It simply says that individuals can unlock their own devices, but it still keeps the underlying technology as illegal. So unlocking is effectively still illegal. And then on Thursday, Senator Amy Klobuchar and Mike Lee, as well as Congressman Eshoo, introduced legislation that would empower the FCC to require that wireless carriers permit their customers to unlock their phones. It's a very confusing law that very few people are sure on what it actually accomplishes, and it doesn't seem to deal with the problem at hand. So far, there have been two legislative attempts, and neither of them have actually solved the problem yet. But we have more bills upcoming next week, and just a few minutes ago, we got word that Chairman Goodlatte and Ranking Member Conyers on the House side are preparing their own bill that should be out next week. So we're going to see what direction they go in as well.
All right. Evan, any final thoughts on this?
No, I was just doing a little search. It was all the way back in 2007. It was March of 2007. There was a bill in Congress called the Fair Use Act. So, yeah, that's the last I remember there being any serious legislation on this. And otherwise, I was kind of zoning out while I was searching for that.
Derek, I see you. Go ahead.
If I can just touch on some of the other issues that really should be on Congress's table, you know, once they fix this problem, we still have the issue of jailbreaking and accessibility technology and computer science research that really haven't been addressed here. So jailbreaking, this will blow your mind. It's legal if you want to jailbreak your iPhone, but it's illegal to jailbreak an iPad. That doesn't make very much sense. And developing the technology. And developing the technology, the tools, trafficking the tools, selling the tools, that technology is still – the underlying technology is still illegal, which is crazy when you have 23 million jailbroken devices in the world. And that ruling that made that lawful just went into effect. So you probably had 23 million felons in the United States for violating this law. So the jailbreaking issue also needs to be on the table in the long run. There's no reason why you have a law that could make 23 million Americans felons subject to the review of the Librarian of Congress. And the other issue that I mentioned before was the accessibility technology. I mean, think about it. We have technology that could help persons who are deaf and who are blind to be able to, better absorb media, learn from books, and to be able to deal with their condition. But we have a law that by default, not by a congressional choice, but by default makes using those technologies illegal or developing those technologies illegal. What type of a crazy system have we developed where, you know, helping persons who are deaf or blind is illegal? And the idea that that can't also be on the table at the same time is pretty sad. And, you know, that's just scratching the surface there. But there's a whole bunch of issues that really should be explored through a congressional hearing on these issues. And it is a lot more than just this unlocking issue. We've discovered that by default, we have a system that bans technology, and that should be problematic.
Are ebooks a different story? I mean, we're not talking about choosing your carrier, or are we? You could choose to be in the iBooks universe or the Kindle universe or the Nook universe. Right now, there's only minor crossover between those three and others. So we're not necessarily talking about the same. I mean, it's similar issue, not quite the same issue. There is a new petition that's asking the same kind of logic to be applied to ebooks. Derek, why should that be?
I'm not part of that petition. Mm-hmm. I'm not fully versed in what the ebook people are asking for. I don't think that that argument's quite as compelling as mm-hmm. ensuring that we have accessibility technology for persons who are blind or deaf. Mm-hmm. Some of the ebook things, I think they want to have people be able to break through the DRM of their own ebooks. I think that is more difficult to accomplish on Capitol Hill, and it brings up issues involving piracy. And I'm more interested in finding examples of where the law has really gone awry. And, you know, these issues as far as accessibility technology or unlocking or jailbreaking were not the initial purpose of the DMCA and have nothing to do with copyright.
Right. The ebook petition has a pretty provocative statement in it. The purchase of a book, whether online or not, is a purchase, not a license. I think the ebook sellers would take large issue with that.
Well,
go ahead.
I mean, just broadly speaking about ebooks, I mean, when you buy a book in the physical world, you know, it's yours to own. You can pass it on when you die. You can borrow, you can let somebody, you can lend it to somebody for them to read and they can give it back. But when we're talking about books on Kindles or any other ebook service, it is something akin to a license. So, you know, you can't necessarily loan it out to whoever you want. And they could potentially take it away. There was a story online the other day talking about how somebody whose country changed in their ebook all of a sudden lost all of their books because they had thought they had moved out of country or something. And so, you know, this is the same type of issue, I think. The larger, you know, when you buy something, you have the right to own it and do what you want. Obviously, there are piracy issues when it comes to unlocking books, but those are situations that we can look for other solutions to rather than locking down people's property and, you know, not allowing them to do what they want with it.
So it was January of last year that we were bidding farewell to SOPA and PIPA. A little more than a year later, the copyright reform engine keeps rolling on. Derek, what's next after cell phone unlocking? Are you going to continue to focus on this issue?
Well, you know, we obviously have to get this issue across the finish line, but I really see this as an opening gambit going forward. You know, the Anti-SOPA Coalition really mobilized last year in a pretty profound way, you know, over 1 million people reaching out to their member of Congress. And that whole story really hasn't been told even today. But that coalition is potentially reemerging to actually push for affirmative solutions and actually change the, you know, politics in a positive direction rather than just ensure that we don't regress in a negative direction by stopping bad bills like SOPA. And so this was one of the first issues that's begun to engage that coalition in an affirmative battle. And it's going to be interesting to see where they go going forward after unlocking, obviously, some of the other issues I addressed on the table as being potential next steps. Obviously, they have quite bigger ambitions, such as CFAA reform, but it's going to require a working coalition and some of these small victories to mounting going forward to become a stronger entity, to become a lobbying force for the internet community.
So you're a coder yourself, aren't you?
Yeah, I've dabbled in coding and C++ and a little Visual Basic, not advanced stuff, as I'm sure people will laugh when they hear that, and of course HTML, but not a professional coder by any means.
I just think it's it's neat to see how. Do you mind my asking how old you are?
25.
It's just great to see your generation coming up with your background. You know, you've definitely grown up both online and using computers all your life. And you not only grasp that world, but the very intricate policy ramifications surrounding it. So it's great to know that you're out there doing what you're doing. My question about these issues, it's hard to think of them in a partisan context at all. They affect everyone. Do you think that either party has the leg up on leading the charge? Glenn Reynolds wrote that this was the Republican Party's opportunity to become cool if they got behind your memo and pursued it. Do you think they get that?
No, it's definitely a major opportunity for Republicans and conservatives to jump onto. But I don't think this has to be a partisan issue. I've had a lot of relationships and coalitions working across lines that are quite unusual on this issue. It really is one of those who understand technology and care about substantive policy, and those who just don't understand. And that dynamic is almost more important than the political divide. Now, as a Republican, I do want Republicans to run on this issue, and I think it's a strongly conservative issue. But you know, we're going to have a whole bunch of successes that are going to require Republicans and Democrats and Libertarians and whomever else wants to join.
Yeah, you made a point in one of your articles that copyright is really a very anti-laissez-faire kind of law and legal structure when you think about it, that it allows people to just sort of sit back and collect rent on something they did, you know, in some cases 70 years ago. And that's not really, you know, in keeping with innovation and competition and all the things that Republicans like to foster.
Absolutely. I mean, my memo said, that is not laissez-faire capitalism. Some people have reported that as me saying, therefore, I'm against copyright. But the memo is very explicit that I actually support copyright. Just because it's not laissez-faire capitalism does not mean that it's not a good thing. It means that we should it's fixing a market failure, a market failure that even our founding fathers recognized in the 18th century. But it means that you have to be very careful with this instrument. I call it a Goldilocks-like test. You want some copyright, but you don't want too much copyright. And these are issues that Republicans really should embrace. Copyright's a form of regulation. It's a form of regulation that if you talk to small businesses and entrepreneurs, that's actually stifles innovation. It actually hinders derivative works. So these are issues that Republicans should really latch on to if they're serious about, you know, less regulation, small businesses, economic growth. There's a lot to work on in the copyright sphere. And you know, this cell phone unlocking issue is part and parcel, which this is technically under copyright law, but you're actually, you know, disallowing a whole class of technology, or jailbreaking in particular. There's a large market for jailbroken apps and all those type of things that actually could increase cybersecurity for your phones. And those markets have just been disallowed by copyright law. So these are issues that Republicans and people who care about innovation should really be taking up.
Well, I think we'll make Republican cool our first MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. Trevor, any thoughts before we move on from cell phone unlocking and copyright reform?
No, I mean, I think Derek has pretty much nailed the issue, and it's just great to see that this is finally coming to the forefront in the public's mind and not just, you know, a small segment of the tech community.
Evan?
Still on the lookout to, you know, recognize the importance of the issue. But, you know, I appreciate Derek's hard work on it.
Well, I mean, Evan, if I can just challenge you one more time. I mean, we have a law on the books that by default, as technology progresses, it says almost, you shall go no further. You know, Gandalf in Lord of the Rings. You know, all these this whole class of technology is by default disallowed. And if you want to use it, we'll allow for individuals to potentially use it if they petition every 3 years and we feel like granting them permission. I mean, that's a crazy person system. And the idea that it's invaded this far into our personal liberty where we can fight it on the unlocking issue, it's just the tip of the spear. So I don't understand how this is a small issue if you're serious about technology and innovation when you have a system that has disallowed technological progress in the future.
Yeah, you make another excellent point that it comes down to the decision, too, of one bureaucrat, not an elected representative, the Librarian of Congress.
Absolutely. And the Librarian of Congress's decision, it's interesting, as you guys are lawyers, I'm sure you know this. You know, it's a legal joke that if you frame things the right way, you can always get the right answer to the question. And the Librarian of Congress is essentially being asked, does this fulfill a vital market need? And that was their reasoning behind this decision. They said, oh, well, but there's already some unlocked phones in the market, so therefore consumers don't need to be able to do that. But the decision should actually be a congressional decision, which is this technology so terrible for society, so harmful to other people, that we should actively ban that technology? There's an overwhelming governmental interest to ban the technology, not that the government has chosen that it fulfills a market niche. You know, who is the librarian of Congress to be making that determination anyways? They're not even in the Commerce Department, they're the librarian. But you're framing the decision on that market niche question as opposed to a personal liberty question, and Congress at least can be weighing those questions about, you know, personal liberty and is this an important violation? Is this a worthwhile violation of our liberty? And I'm not a purist. There are some technologies that may be disallowable: drones, rocket launchers, nuclear bombs. Obviously, we shouldn't have a system that, you know, permits those and without any form of regulation. But allowing the librarian just to disallow a technology because it's not vital for the economy, in their opinion, is pretty crazy.
Well, I think that's Evan? Overstating it a little bit. And, you know, there are all kinds of technologies that we're restricted from using in the ways that we want to use them. And nobody, you know, puts up much of a fuss about that. I mean, if I had a bunch of money, I could go buy a Lamborghini, but I couldn't drive it down the interstate at 150 miles an hour without being subject to certain restrictions that the law puts forward and, you know, that most people are willing to abide by. My biggest objection
Derek, I let you talk.
You know, I mean, we've got these, you know, these we've got these restrictions in place in a very narrow market segment, and you know, I guess it loses a little bit of a credibility when we talk about all this, you know, this terrible violation of our liberties when we're talking about a very narrow specific market segment that is subject to these exemptions, or you know, no longer subject to these exemptions. And I guess there's got to be a countervailing side, which I see some merit to. You know, again, it's blasphemy. I know this is when I get tomatoes thrown at me from the IRC and stuff, but there is an actual interest in a certain protection of the innovation that goes on, you know, in the development of these devices. A couple guys hacking a phone in their basement are not going to come up with the next, you know, iPhone or the next, you know, revolutionary kind of device. That's left for industry that, you know, the law should, you know, recognize some protection for.
And I favor protection for industry as well. And of course, we obviously have contract law, but your example about the Lamborghini is obviously a social harm, which is a very good reason for regulating their conduct in international, you know, in commerce. I don't think that has anything to do with the situation at hand.
All right.
Yeah, it seems strange that, you know, we're talking about it's I take issue, Evan, with the fact that you I forget exactly how you characterized it, but a very narrow market segment being affected by the DMCA and its anti-circumvention provisions. And I think, you know, it's basically any piece of technology that someone chooses to lock up that's a huge market segment.
Well, the thing that's getting us all upset here is the lapsing of that exception to 1201, which deals with cell phones. That's what I'm talking about, a narrow market segment. I'm not saying I'm not talking about the, you know, section 1201, section 1202 in general.
Okay. All right. Well, it's a fascinating issue. We're really happy to have gotten all your insights, Derek, and we'll continue to follow along as it unfolds. As you say, it's not over yet. But we're going to move on and talk about some other topics. But before we do that, I'm going to thank our first sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, and that is ShareFile by Citrix. You know, the business world, the world of communication has all changed. You know, just like we've been talking about the DMCA not keeping up with technologies have changed how we all do business. We no longer write each other letters and faxes and things. We need to get large digital files to one another in order to get our work done. Most business emails include some sort of attachment. You've got documents, spreadsheets, PowerPoints, contracts. We've got, of course, large video files that are really hard to move around. We need that information to be received and get it into the right hands and remain confidential. But it can't always get there. Technology hasn't quite kept up with the fact that things get larger and larger and need to get there instantaneously and need to stay secure. That's the niche that ShareFile is filling here. That's why it's important to every single business. ShareFile by Citrix sends your attachments as secure links, so you can send files of almost any size with the highest degree of security and receive notifications when your files have been opened and by who. So you've found out that your opposing counsel, for example, has received that notice that you sent them, and they can't later backtrack and say, oops, no, never got it. ShareFile is easy to use and integrates into any business. Plus, with ShareFile, you can access files from anywhere, your laptop, your tablet, or your smartphone. So it's a great remote access tool, too. Keeps you in touch on the go. I highly recommend ShareFile. If you're not using ShareFile yet, you need to sign up for my free trial now. No credit card is required. There's nothing to lose. You'll see why millions of professionals rely on it every day. So get started today with this special 30-day free trial. Go to ShareFile.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and enter TWIL, T-W-I-L. That's ShareFile.com, and type in TWIL. Thank you so much, ShareFile, for your support of This Week in Law. Let us talk about some important developments on the privacy front. So we had a decision out of the Supreme Court of the United States recently, Clapper versus Amnesty International. It was a very close decision. The court split 5-4 on whether courts should be able to hear a constitutional challenge to the 2008 Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act amendments, which permit warrantless surveillance of persons overseas. Trevor, you've been paying attention to this. Was this a big blow from the Supreme Court?
Yeah, absolutely. Let me just talk first about kind of what the FISA Amendments Act does, because I think that's important in understanding why this ruling was such a disappointment. You know, the FISA Amendments Act was passed in 2008 after the Bush administration's warrantless wiretapping was exposed by the New York Times. And instead of fixing this problem, Congress basically tried to legalize this as then what was an illegal and unconstitutional program. And basically what it allows the government to do is any American that is communicating with anybody overseas, they can wiretap pretty much everybody. The way it works is that they have to go to this secret court where nobody is allowed to actually, I mean, basically the government goes by themselves and asks the judge for an order where they can go after categories and groups of people. So they can literally say anybody that is communicating with anybody out of, you know, anybody in Russia or anybody in Israel or anybody in Afghanistan and suck up all of those communications. And while they're focusing on the person overseas, they're also collecting the Americans' communications. And normally, the U.S. government should have to get a warrant to read any sort of Americans' communications. But here, the standard is much lower, and they don't even need to individualize or call out an individual when they're getting this information. So the ACL, when this law was passed, the ACLU challenged it in 2008. And the government has argued that because the ACLU can't prove for a certainty that their clients had been wiretapped. Now, these clients were like journalists and human rights campaigners and lawyers for people who were most likely probably to be wiretapped. And so, you know, these lawyers basically had to take huge precautions, like they couldn't even talk to their clients via email or phone. They had to fly to see them because they were worried about all of their communications being tapped. Obviously, attorneys have attorney-client privileges where they have to, you know, ethically, they have to keep their conversations private. So, you know, there's these huge expenses that go along with this, trying to avoid the surveillance. And so the Supreme Court essentially agreed with the government, saying that the plaintiffs didn't have standing because they actually couldn't prove for a certainty that they were being spied on. Now, the problem is it's impossible for them to prove with a certainty that they're being spied on because the government keeps all this information secret. They, for the past you know, however many years, 6 or 8 years, they have been absolutely stonewalling every journalism investigation, every FOIA request, and every congressional attempt to get more transparency on this wiretapping program. And so it's really this catch-22 where no one's allowed to challenge this law, the secret law, because everything involved with it is secret. And so therefore, the government can essentially do whatever they want and are essentially unaccountable.
Yeah, it definitely sounds like Catch-22 when you describe it that way. So there really is nothing that we can do at this point, right? The Supreme Court has looked at this, and if the act is going to change, it's not going to come from a constitutional challenge. It has to come from Congress, right?
Yeah, exactly. And Congress actually extended this law for 5 years, actually, at the end of December in 2012. And unfortunately, there were three or four privacy amendments and transparency amendments that were really modest in scope and that really wouldn't have changed the program at all. It just would have, like, for example, one of them would have forced the government to give a general estimate of how many American communications are affected by this law. And the administration and most of Congress still opposed it. So unfortunately, for at least the next 5 years, this law will be in place with no added privacy protections. But the good news is that actually EFF still has a lawsuit that is alive against the NSA warrantless wiretapping program. And even though a lot of them have been shut down by these procedural maneuvers, like, for example, there was another one last year that the government claimed sovereign immunity, which was this complicated, legal doctrine where, essentially the plaintiffs couldn't sue the government itself. They had to sue the individuals in their personal capacities in the government. And because they filed their suit wrong, even though a previous court had ruled for them and ruled what the government was doing unconstitutional, that their case got thrown out. So EFF still has a case alive. And in our case, the government is trying to prevent this evidence from coming forward as well. In our case, they're arguing the state secrets privilege, basically saying that anything that we can't litigate the case, even if everything that we say is true, because the case would implicate state secrets. And so it should be dismissed. This really doesn't make any sense when you look at just the plain reading of everything, because there's thousands of pages of evidence in the public record talking about warrantless wiretapping from every major news organization. We have whistleblowers from the NSA and AT&T talking about this type of dragnet surveillance that they're running. But the government is going to do everything in their power to prevent this from ever being adjudicated. And unfortunately, it looks like our case is the last hope of anything happening within the next 5 or 10 years.
Well, that's why we love the EFF, is they take on the important issues even when they have a long slog ahead of them.
Absolutely.
Thank you once again, EFF, for keeping the heat on there. Evan, any thoughts about this decision?
I mean, it just seems like such an intractable problem, because you see what the catch 22 problem is, or choose your metaphor, chicken and egg problem, bootstrapping problem, whatever. The plaintiffs in this lawsuit, in the one in New York, not the EFF's case, but the ACLU case, I mean, they didn't have standing, the court held, because they didn't have enough information as to harm. But then again, they didn't have information as to harm because the government said it was secret and the government kept it secret. Now, that's a huge problem. It's an insurmountable problem that the plaintiffs had in this. But, you've got on one side, you can see the government interest in the secrecy because, hey, after all, it's national security, right? We've got to protect ourselves from, all the different harms and the entities out there who both, domestic and foreign, who would seek to do us harm, right? But at the same time, that is really scary, isn't it? That the government has this black box, this metaphorical black box that it can do this stuff in, and the courts are willing to validate and protect any kind of challenge to that. So I don't see any way of effectively resolving that problem and keeping all the interests perfectly in balance. Whether the ACLU suit would have gone forward, or the God willing, the EFF's efforts, see some good results here. It's one of the most difficult problems I could see that we have to solve in terms of civil liberties and national security.
Derek, what do you think?
I think it's a really unfortunate problem. Having worked in Congress, this is one of those issues that there's a strong incentive to be tough on national security, and there's much less of an incentive to unfortunately care about privacy issues. It almost reminded me, if I could be so controversial, of Scalia's argument this week on the Civil Rights Act. What he was trying to say was about the Civil Rights Act that no one was willing to vote against it, even if they have legitimate criticisms of that act. Similarly, on some of these national security issues, even if people have concerns with some of the privacy things, they're very scared to vote against the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act and other acts like it.
It strikes me too, Derek, that we're looking at another sort of nonpartisan issue here that is important to everyone across the board, not just in this particular case with FISA and surveillance of people overseas, but the privacy issue in general seems to me to be important to the core to each and every voting person in the U.S. And yet it doesn't seem to me that either party has figured out a way to address current concerns. Do you agree?
I think that's absolutely true. One thing that I thought was really interesting in this case was, the dissent's perspective on standing overall. Breyer's theory on probabilistic injuries to determine standing. If that had won out, it would have been a pretty significant change in standing law, case law for the Supreme Court. But I thought it was really unfortunate. And you see this all across the board on national security issues where almost nobody has standing. And the standings are hypothetical. The majority in this case said, well, you would have standing if they introduced this evidence in a domestic trial. But of course, that's probably not going to happen. So the standing issue is very, very problematic. It's very similar to the political question doctrine.
Yep, it definitely is a thorny issue. And again, I guess if we're going to see any change along these lines, it's going to have to come from Congress, because the courts have put their hands off it at this point. Evan, I know you need to run, so we'll go ahead and bid you a fond farewell until next week.
Yes. Yeah. Great talking with you. Thanks for having me on. I hope, I trust that the rest of the conversation will go really well. Trevor, great to talk to you again. And Derek, let me know when you're in Chicago. I'll buy you a beer and we'll talk about cell phone unlocking. So I'll see you all later.
Yeah. You guys can sit in the bar and hack your phones.
Thank you soon.
We'll see you next week, Evan. Take care.
Right on. See ya.
All right. Why don't we take another little break here and thank our second sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, and that is LegalZoom. I have a couple of people in mind who, if they haven't looked at LegalZoom, should definitely do so. Number one, if you're that person who does contracts on the back of a bar napkin, speaking of sitting in a bar and hacking your phones, you have some sort of arrangement you want to reach with someone, but you're in a hurry, you want to set forth the deal points really quickly, you want to get it done, you want to move forward, you don't want to involve a lawyer at this point because you feel like it's too simple and maybe too expensive. If you do these back of the napkin kind of agreements, I litigated for a good chunk of my legal career. And those are the kinds of things that always wind up in court. People try and do it themselves without any kind of guidance or structure, and their intent gets lost in the shuffle. So you are a person, if you're a back of the napkin kind of fly by the seat of the pants business person, you need to be taking a look at LegalZoom. For example, if you want to start a business, you can incorporate a business or form an LLC at LegalZoom starting for just $99. So that way you're going to form it the right way. It's going to save you money on taxes. It's going to ensure your personal assets are legally protected. It can also help with trademarks, copyrights, patents, NDAs. That might be one of those kind of back of the napkin things that people do. And a whole lot more. If you have a family, if you have friends, if you have colleagues that you enter into arrangements with, guess what? You need to make sure that you and they are protected too. You can protect your family and assets with a LegalZoom will for just $69 or establish a living trust. If you don't have a will and you leave it up to the government and courts to decide what happens with your family and assets, that's kind of a big mess. If you enter into, again, arrangements with your friends or colleagues. Suppose you loan someone money. You're going to need a note to document that. this is the kind of thing that LegalZoom is great on. You're going to find forms there that are going to get you right on your way. The other person that I have in mind that if they haven't checked out LegalZoom, they really should, is an in-house counsel. If you know you're looking for a starting point to kickstart something very simple for the company, say you're a startup, again, things are on a budget, LegalZoom would be a great starting point for a lot of areas, could certainly help you get the ball rolling with your outside law firms too, and save you money along the way. If you don't have an outside law firm, if you're just an individual or a company who's not represented by lawyers, if you have further questions and need advice about the kinds of things that you find on LegalZoom, you can access an extensive network of attorneys through LegalZoom's legal plans, which are available in most states. You can search online profiles and unedited customer reviews to work with a LegalZoom plan attorney who's right for you and your business. So start your business and protect your family today at LegalZoom.com. LegalZoom is not a law firm. You can get self-help services at your specific direction, or you can speak to a legal plan attorney and get your questions answered and get ongoing advice. To receive a special thank you for using LegalZoom through TWIT, make sure you enter the offer code TWIL, T-W-I-L, in the referral box at checkout. You'll get $10 off. So go to LegalZoom.com, use the offer code TWIL. Thank you so much, LegalZoom, for your support of This Week in Law. Let me ask you guys, Derek and Trevor, whether either of you feels like you understand what's going on with Firefox and Do Not Track. This is a story that we had in our discussion points that, frankly, I'm just kind of glancing at now. So unless either of you feel strongly about it, maybe we'll move on. Going.
I mean, yeah. I can talk about it really briefly.
Okay.
Without getting into too many specifics, but basically there has been this really big debate about Do Not Track and the way advertisers can track internet users online for the last year or so, where privacy groups like EFF and a bunch of others want users to be able to opt out of this type of tracking. So third parties can basically see every website that you go to and can know basically every little detail about your life by knowing where you browse online. And unfortunately, there's no real easy way to opt out of this strategy, this advertising strategy. And so what Firefox has done is what we're advocating that all of these browsers do, which is allow users to send out a signal that will essentially stop these cookies, they're called, from being installed on your computer so that these third parties can track you. Firefox is now putting this in by default in their browser instead of having users to turn it on, because as we know, a lot of people don't actually know that this tracking is even going on. Unfortunately, advertisers are making billions of dollars off people when they really have no idea. And so what this does is really protects the privacy of the users, and hopefully with such a major browser like Firefox doing this, it'll kind of encourage the other major browsers to do it as well.
How is this different from what Explorer has done?
It's actually kind of the same thing.
Okay.
Unfortunately, we need to convince all of the advertisers to actually, follow this rule, and that's kind of what the Do Not Track negotiations are about.
Got it. So this was just recently announced. Let's see, this post February 25th on the Mozilla Privacy blog. Do you know if it's getting the same kind of blowback that it actually is not permitting people to choose by turning this on by default?
I think this has kind of flown more under the radar than Microsoft's decision, because, mm-hmm. First of all, Firefox has obviously been on the forefront of privacy issues for a long time, and a big part of their business is nonprofit, whereas Microsoft is seen as this kind of huge corporation. So I think it was reacted to differently. But I'm sure the advertisers will fight against it, just as they have against Microsoft's decision.
All right. Well, we will continue to keep an eye on that. Derek, any thoughts on Do Not Track?
Yeah, I thought that the Firefox development was really good news. The amount of cookies from third parties that we have on our computers, most of us barely even notice. That's why having a good actor take the lead and kind of make these things default is kind of a good thing. I don't know if you've read Cass Sunstein's book Nudge, but he talks about the power of the default option and allowing for people to opt out as being a very dynamically different thing than just allowing for people to opt in. So I think, hopefully this technology becomes the de facto for web browsers going forward.
Right. Again, I mean, it's sort of a similar situation. You want advertisers to be similar to the situation of the continuum we were talking about before with cell phone unlocking. You want advertisers to be able to compete and gather the information they need to from willing users, but you want people to be able to meaningfully opt out if that's what they want. And right now, as you say, Derek, people just don't even realize what's happening to them.
Absolutely. And some of these cookies are accumulating vast quantities of data that you probably would never suspect. And, some of this data is supposed to be anonymized, but what we find is as computing power gets more powerful and there's more sources to cross-compare that data, there are enough data points to basically identify most people. This type of information quickly has implications that are not just anonymized.
So as part of the Republican Party getting cool, you think that they will jump into the do not track fray?
We'll see. I mean, I don't think the solution is to mandate do not track. So it's unclear what the congressional involvement should be. My perspective is generally the government should get out of the way. The unlocking issue, the government should not make that a felony. And you can deal with that through contract law. In this issue, it's a perfect example of where, Mozilla is taking the lead on this and they're actually pushing something positive into the market. So it doesn't seem like it needs to be mandated by the federal government. And I think there is a purpose for cookies. But having, the web browsers as kind of a middleman, they haven't yet played a very positive role, but they can play a positive role. And we even saw that with Microsoft with Internet Explorer, where people by default opt in to do not track. So they've already started to venture into this arena as being a safeguard for users. And obviously, baby steps. But I think it's the beginning of a direction going forward.
All right. Well, in honor of this next story, I'm going to make Alitalia our second MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. If you're wondering what I'm talking about, if you're a legal professional or in another field where you can get educational kind of credit from your regulatory or trade association, you can go on over to the Twit Wiki, the Twill page. We have lots of information on getting either mandatory continuing legal education credit for This Week in Law or credit in whatever other field you may need it for that is pertinent to what we talk about here on the show. So in order to demonstrate to those bodies that you've listened, we drop in these passphrases to the show. Some states require that. So our second one for today is Alitalia. And that is because there was an airline landing in New York, I believe at LaGuardia, that almost bumped into a drone, at least saw one out there, and it freaked the pilot out a bit. Derek, I hope you don't mind if I call you our little droney, since you are so up to speed on all issues relating to surveillance and other drones. This particular one sounds like the AR drone that my son flies around, that it was like a quadcopter thing, perhaps, that freaked out the Alitalia pilot. Is this kind of thing becoming more and more of a problem as these toys and other drones become more and more common, Trevor?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think we're just going to see more of this in the future. Last year, the Congress passed this law called the FAA Modernization Act, and buried in this bill was a clause that said that the FAA was basically mandated to start handing out drone licenses to any public agency that wanted them. Now, this situation here was probably a hobbyist drone who was flying too close to the airport. We don't really know, but You know, soon police officers and agencies around the country are going to start flying similar drones to this, although they'll be much more expensive and have much more high-tech surveillance capabilities, like, you know, not even high-definition cameras, but, you know, infrared and heat sensors that can see through walls, facial recognition technology, radar, even, you know, cell phone interception gear. And so, you know, that even the FAA itself estimates that by 2017, there may be as many as 10,000 flying in the U.S. So, you know, not only do we have these safety problems where drones may be flying near airlines and airports, but we have huge privacy concerns where if these drones can potentially stay in the air for hours or days at a time, they could follow anybody they want outside their doorstep without any sort of warrant or what or any sort of court order whatsoever, because, you know, our laws aren't really equipped to handle this technology. And so that's actually a lot of what I've been doing at EFF lately, is trying to develop a policy framework to deal with this and to also just educate the American public on the amount of drones that actually may be flying in the U.S. Over the next couple of years.
Well, and it's particularly critical since the administration now says they can use legal force against Americans on U.S. soil as of this week. Is that right? They kind of backed off that a bit?
Yeah, you know, it's I think it's still kind of unclear, but basically what happened is, yeah, we have like these two separate drone issues. We have one where it's being used as this pretty much overarching military tool now, where the administration thinks that they can use drones to shoot missiles at terrorism suspects overseas, even when they're not on the traditional battlefield. And so this has been happening in many countries beyond Afghanistan, like Pakistan and Yemen and Somalia. And over almost 5,000 people have been killed by missiles from drones, and including American citizens. And so this is where the controversy really started, where, you know, again, we have this issue where there's so much secrecy, where the government basically claims that everything is classified. And so the American public really doesn't have a chance to debate it one way or the other. And, you know, about a month ago, a legal memo leaked to NBC News, which talked about the administration's rationale for potentially killing Americans with drone strikes or by other means, without any due process or court involved whatsoever. And so that's where this controversy really started. And now Congress has been demanding answers about, well, if they can do this overseas, do they have the authority to do it in the U.S.? And when, you know, the CIA director nominee John Brennan was asked this question, and President Obama was asked this question, and finally Eric Holder was asked this question, they seemed to dodge it and actually insinuate that, yes, they did have this power in what they called extraordinary circumstances, which were as of yet undefined. But after Rand Paul actually held a 13-hour filibuster the other day, the administration came out and more definitively said, you know, barring some sort of Pearl Harbor-style attack, that they claimed that they wouldn't use this power in the U.S. Now, you know, I think there's still left some ambiguity there that people really have some concerns about. And there's, you know, still huge concerns about them using this power overseas as well, because, you know, American citizens don't lose their rights when they go overseas. You know, so I think we definitely haven't seen the last of this controversy. But it just goes to show that drones, both overseas and in the U.S., are becoming huge issues in this country.
So I'm sure it's fun in D.C., Derek, when there's a good filibuster.
Yeah, I mean, filibusters are always one of the most interesting things that happens. Rand Paul's filibuster was I know that there are critics, but actually, if you pull some of the quotations out, considering he was speaking for 12 hours, I personally found it to be remarkably substantive. I just think the accomplishment of filibustering for 12 hours and having legitimate content to say for 12 hours rather than going through the phone book is a pretty impressive feat. And this is a conversation that's, you know, really well past due. You know, some people in the media started saying, you know, it's an absurdity, the idea that an American citizen would just be killed and the president wouldn't do that. But what you do is you take the most extreme examples and you use that in order to investigate how a law can be abused. You don't look at how the law is probably going to be used. You don't say, well, we're okay giving the president the ability to kill people because realistically he's only going to use it against the really bad people. you have to create a system that can operate in the worst case scenario. You know, if you're a Democrat, you need a system that can operate with a George W. Bush in office. If you're a Republican, you want a system that can operate with Barack Obama in office. So you have to have a system that is able to survive in that world. And when you're giving the president the authority to kill American citizens, that should require strict scrutiny by the congressional branch. And that really hasn't happened, even after the killing of Anwar al-Awlaki, even after the killing of Anwar al-Awlaki's son, which was perhaps an even more outrageous situation. So it was very good to see Rand Paul take this stand. And I think Republicans are getting a new look from a lot of young people who are pretty impressed by Rand Paul's filibuster.
Yeah, I think it's amazing. You know, I think if this was George Bush and this was 2007, you would see Senator Obama up there with Rand Paul filibustering this type of, huge expansion of executive power. And unfortunately, we've seen the situation, as Derek mentioned, where, you know, this has kind of become a partisan issue instead of a nonpartisan issue, where if this was a Republican in office, then it would be Democrats that would be doing this filibustering. And, thankfully, Ron Paul, has taken a more principled stand than most senators. And Ron Wyden as well on the Democratic side actually joined him for a little while, which was good to see.
Just got to point out that it's Rand Paul, not Ron Paul.
Did I say Ron? I meant Rand.
Yeah. It's a common...
I bet you that happens a lot. Absolutely. like I was saying, it was disappointing to see that there weren't more Democrats standing up for civil liberties, which they considered one of their mainline values back in the 2000s before President Obama was in the White House.
Yeah, absolutely. And Derek, can you tell us where the administration is deriving its authority, or does it even explain that?
I didn't read over all their materials that they provided, but it seems like part of the authority is from the authorization for use from 2001, and then there, of course there was a renewal of the authorization of use. I think it was the 2012 NDAA, which is a pretty broad authorization for the use of force. And that's kind of where some of this, comes down, is how broad is the presidential war-making function. And we've actually had a lot of interesting conversations about, we've authorized this perpetual war. And in so doing, the president has allowed to have really quite extraordinary powers. But the war on terror has really progressed into an indefinite war that is almost a different scale of war from a traditional war. And it doesn't seem like it's ever going to end. So is it appropriate to continue to grant these, unlimited war-making powers indefinitely in the future? I think a lot of people are starting to have a lot of questions about that and be very concerned.
Yes, it's of course concerning when a drone is not only, following you around and surveilling you, but can take you out. Definitely an issue. Trevor, what do you think about the surveillance issues right now? It seems like on a local level, lots of law enforcement agencies have been struggling with this issue as to whether and how they're going to keep tabs on citizens.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think we've seen an expansion of surveillance capabilities by law enforcement using technology over the last decade, that's almost wholly unprecedented. When we think about the location on our cell phones, we carry our cell phones around for 24 hours a day, and it's actually potentially giving law enforcement our precise location 24 hours a day too. And they actually have been arguing for years now that they don't need a warrant for this information, that they can just get it with a subpoena, which is a much lower threshold and doesn't require a judge's signature at all. And so they've really been abusing this power to the point where last year there was 1.5 million people who had their cell phone location information taken by law enforcement. They went to your cell phone carrier and asked them for it. Literally millions of people. And so, we see the same thing with email, where the law enforcement doesn't think they need a warrant in certain situations. And so, with the advance of technology, I think, you know, sometimes the law hasn't kept up. And now we're seeing the same type of situation develop with domestic drones and privacy. And thankfully, actually, people are actually getting out in front of this issue. So, you know, even though there may be 10,000 drones in the sky in 5 years from now, right now there are only about 100 police agencies that have licenses to fly them. Yet this is becoming a huge issue in the public mind. You know, even just in the last month, since state legislatures have reconvened, there have been 30 states that have introduced privacy bills related to drones to restrict drone surveillance, to require warrants for this type of surveillance. So that's been hugely encouraging. And you know, keeping with the theme of today's show, I think it's actually been the most bipartisan issue I've probably ever seen at EFF, where, you know, Tea Party Republicans are teaming up with the ACLU or you know, really liberal Democrats in all of these states to try to pass these laws to make sure that, you know, people aren't being spied on in their backyard or as they walk outside their front door by drones.
Is there any kind of common theme that you can glean from the 30 states that are enacting or considering legislation along these lines?
A lot of the legislation looks different. Some of them are putting moratoriums on police buying drones or police using drones for criminal activity. Some of them are putting in warrant requirements. Others are just asking for more information. But the common theme seems to be that these drones or these bills are being introduced to protect privacy. And that's kind of a new situation. We're usually used to Congress and state legislatures trying to avoid privacy issues and avoid passing privacy laws. So this is really an encouraging development.
All right. Anything else we should know from the dronosphere before we move on?
I think we've covered it.
All right. Let's go on then and talk about your new position, Trevor, as director of the Freedom of Press Foundation. First, tell us what that is and give us a bit of background.
Sure. So we started the Freedom of Press Foundation about 2 months ago. Now we launched in the middle of December of 2012. And our basic goal is to protect, support, and defend all sorts of journalism organizations, mostly independent and nonprofit, that focus on transparency and accountability in government. So, you know, I think there's two overarching issues here. First, you know, government secrecy is at an all-time high. And as we've been talking about with warrantless wiretapping or drones, a lot of times the government operates under, you know, this veil of secrecy, which allows them to pretty much act unaccountable and from either Congress or the courts. And so we want to kind of shine light on these issues and support journalism organizations that aggressively report on them. To do that, what we're doing is every 2 months we're taking a bundle of four organizations and running a fundraising campaign for them to try to get them more visibility. But the main organization that we have been supporting to start with is WikiLeaks. And this is kind of where the second half of this organization, or where this organization actually sprung from, which was, you know, 2 years ago, WikiLeaks was cut off by Visa, MasterCard, and PayPal after they started publishing the State Department cables that are so famous now, along with the New York Times and other papers. So for decades and decades, you know, newspapers have been publishing classified information, and it's been generally looked at as protected under the First Amendment. Yet for some reason, these payment processors were cutting off WikiLeaks for doing the same thing that these other newspapers were doing, and they hadn't been charged with the crime. And this was only done because a couple congressmen went and unofficially pressured them. And so we thought this was kind of this precedent that was being set that could potentially affect other media organizations down the road. We wanted to make sure it never happened again. So we set this up with the goal in mind that we were going to take donations to WikiLeaks as well, and any other organization this ever happened to in the future. And so far, it's been really successful. For the first 2 months, we raised almost $200,000, $80,000 of that going to WikiLeaks. And, you know, that's more money than they've had in the last 2 years. You know, they've had to really shrink down their organization because they've been under this financial censorship. Been really great news, and you know, we got a lot of money to these other organizations many people hadn't heard of before, and we actually just launched our second bundle of organizations about a month ago, and we're already up to 50,000 in donations and over 500 donors since then. So, so far it's been really good.
That's great. Can you bring us up to speed as to what's going on with Bradley Manning these days? It seems like overreaching based on existing laws. It's been a big theme of our show today, and it comes up here as well.
Yeah, this is a really unfortunate case and could really have huge implications for the press going forward. So a couple weeks ago, he made an appearance in court where he pled guilty to many of the charges that the government had brought against him. The charges he pled guilty to would lead to up to 20 years in jail. And he read a statement on the stand when he was pleading guilty to this for about an hour, explaining his motivations for giving this information to WikiLeaks, why he thought this was important for the public to know, you know, how he went to the New York Times and Washington Post first, but they seemed to ignore him, and how he ended up, you know, basically in the situation he is in today. Unfortunately, despite him pleading guilty to charges that would lead to 20 years in jail, the government is going ahead with much more serious charges that could have him in prison for life. But also could really change the way journalism, journalists and sources interact with each other. There's one charge called aiding the enemy, which basically states that because Al-Qaeda had access to the internet and they could potentially read this information online, that actually Bradley Manning was committing something akin to treason. And this could have huge implications for not only journalists, but also just soldiers who may post information online on their Facebook pages or Twitter or MySpace or anything, where essentially they may take a picture of themselves on a base or write a blog entry, and they could potentially be held liable for this aiding the enemy charge, which has never been, you know, used against somebody who had been posting public information. It had always been used against somebody who was actually directly aiding the enemy. And so, you know, unfortunately, the media hasn't been covering this very, very closely. And Bradley Manning's trial is coming up in June for the rest of these charges. So hopefully there will be a much bigger spotlight on it when it comes. And, you know, the public will really understand how overreaching these charges really are.
Trevor,
go ahead, Derek.
So the main charge against Bradley Manning is under the Espionage Act. Is that right?
Yeah, there are. So besides the aiding the enemy charges, he'll still be being charged under the Espionage Act, too. So the charges that he pled guilty to were kind of talking about him mishandling classified information and all this. But the serious charges are the aiding the enemy and then Espionage Act charges as well.
Well, my understanding, and maybe it's different for military members, my understanding is that merely releasing classified documents was not a violation of the Espionage Act unless the government could prove that those documents were vital to U.S. national security or caused serious harm. Is that a misunderstanding of the Espionage Act?
You know, I wish the Espionage Act was interpreted like that, but a lot of times courts have interpreted it as actually the government doesn't need to prove any harm, which is really outrageous. So in a situation like John Kiriakou, who was the CIA officer who just actually went to jail a couple weeks ago for talking about torture techniques and the CIA officers who did the torture during the Bush administration. The judge ruled that actually he wasn't even going to be allowed to present evidence that this didn't harm the U.S. The same thing goes with Bradley Manning. He's basically took that guilty plea and read information from the stand because he wasn't going to be allowed to, you know, present the same type of information. The only time he could actually present the information about whether this information harmed the U.S. was at his sentencing hearing after he had potentially been found guilty. And, you know, that's a real shame because there are actually the government has admitted there are basically government report after government report stating, you know, talking about the WikiLeaks disclosures and stating how it actually didn't really hurt national security at all. And so, you know, the defense had really been fighting to get this information in front of the judge, but unfortunately the judge won't allow it.
Huh.
Does that come into the analysis? I mean, I'm sure there are lots of people out there who think that it should, whether or not there was harm from the information that was leaked. But does the law require there to be?
Well, my understanding is this book called Tiger Trap by David Weiss, and it talks about some of the espionage wars, and it talks about the difficulty the government often has in prosecuting espionage cases when they try to demonstrate that the information could be harmful. So that's mm-hmm. why I was interested in the application here. But in a world yeah. where merely releasing classified documents is a serious violation of the Espionage Act, rather than just mishandling classified information, which of course is also a charge. But, you know, things are so highly classified that, with 1.2 million Americans having top secret security clearances, it's reasonable to believe that a large number of them probably release incidental classified information by accident, that some of which should never have been classified to begin with. And the idea that they could all be prosecuted for espionage or aiding the enemy is pretty crazy. I mean, Daniel Ellsberg, they threw the kitchen sink at him for the Pentagon Papers, but I don't think they ever charged him with aiding the enemy. I think they charged him with everything else.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's a great point. I mean, that's the problem. You know, basically everything in the foreign policy and national security realm these days is considered classified. And, you know, the government, if the public to know anything about what the government is doing in those realms, the government officials basically have to leak classified information. I mean, the administration does it all the time for their own purposes, whether they're pushing a political objective or, you know, agencies are involved in turf wars where they want to get in the last word and are fighting over budgeting, or it's whistleblowers. And, you know, we had a long history in this country of where, you know, the government would try to keep secrets, but if the media got their hands on them, you know, they were basically free to publish them. And now we have a situation where whistleblowers are actually being prosecuted more than ever before. And, you know, under the Obama administration, they've been charged leakers to the press under the espionage 6 times, which is double the amount of all other administrations combined. And, you know, I think you make another great point about, you know, the Espionage Act, where, you know, this law was passed to prosecute spies and basically traitors to this country. And that is certainly not the same thing as people who were giving information to the general public because they think that they should be aware of it. You know, these things should never be equated under the law. And unfortunately, right now, they increasingly are.
I just keep thinking about what a rotten time it is, based on everything we've talked about on the show today, to be a soldier abroad. Can't unlock your phone without committing a crime. You're going to be warrantlessly surveilled, perhaps, in light of the Clapper decision. What else?
And you can't post a photo or a blog anymore if you're
want
to be considered aiding the enemy.
And there's even more drones overseas. So
that's right. You have to look out for low flying drones as well.
Yep.
So our heart goes out to you, men and women in the service. Hang in there. In the meantime, for our men and women in the service and for all of the rest of you, we have a resource and tip of the week. We'll hopefully make things a little bit better. Our resource of the week is something that I'm actually curious to pick your guys' brain about. I stumbled across it in my email. I think it's called lobbyit.com. And it sort of touts itself as a lobbying firm for the rest of us, where it has economical pricing plans starting at about $1,000 a month, $995 a month, and going up to, you know, if you really want to be taking your issues and getting change in the law, up to $3,000 a month, which I guess is a lot less than you would pay for a conventional lobbying firm. But, you know, given what we saw with SOPA and PIPA, and given, you know, the other tools available to people out there, you know, I don't know if the better resource is lobbyit.com or Reddit. What do you think, Derek?
I always use Reddit. Reddit's my go-to resource for everything. So,
yeah, exactly. I just thought this was really interesting in the days when it seems like every company has a chief policy officer these days watching the developments in Washington. For, you know, even for small businesses, maybe lobbyist is a good solution. I don't know. I'm not endorsing it. I haven't used it. Just seemed like an interesting alternative out there. What do you think, Trevor?
Hey, it sounds great to me.
Yeah. All right. So check it out. And then our tip of the week is, again, looking to Reddit, how you might defeat a bogus trademark on a drinking game. Hysterical story about Ali Spagnola, written up by Andrea James at Boing Boing. Ali is someone who has made some music and other kind of fun things around a drinking game called Power Hour, which I guess I'm too old to ever have played. The idea is you drink, I think, a shot a minute for an hour, some sort of beverage every minute for an hour. And there were, you know, lots of people like Ali who sort of had funny, fun contributions to the world of playing Power Hour. Ali made music. Other people did other things. But one of the members of the Power Hour community decided to trademark the term Power Hour and then started coming after all the rest of them. So Ali, in turn, decided she was going to fight this and tried to challenge it first at the Trademark Trial and Appeal Board before the trademark was even granted. There, due to some sort of administrative error, she didn't quite manage to do that. So she wound up spending $30,000 of her own money to litigate it. And she finally got the trademark set aside with the help of a lot of people on Reddit as well. So I think we might have her video queued up. Take a look at Ali for a minute here.
That tried to push me around. I got into a legal battle about a drinking game. It was weird and insane. I'm rapping quick as I can, I've been a Power Hour minute, but the story's so good, you better take that shot and double it. So here we go, my song about a freaking victory. How I set Power Hour free.
Life's not fair, baby, that's a fact, but don't let some bully stop your party. You push back because you
I love this. All right, I think that's enough of Ali. If you want more of Ali, she actually has a campaign going on Indiegogo right now to fund a tour to go around and celebrate the end of the trademark. So I guess our tip is, you know, get out there. Don't be bullied by a trademark owner. This trademark was determined to be more generic than distinctive and... she won the day on it. So good for you, Ali. And she also went to the folks on Reddit for lots of help. So I guess if you're going to, you know, take any kind of stand and try and garner public support, that's where you want to be. What do you guys think of this?
I mean, that's hilarious. Yeah. That was the first time I'd seen the video, but that's great.
It is awesome.
That's unbelievable video. It's good to see people stand up for their rights and to you know, get a good win for the rest of society and hopefully trademark law going forward.
Right. And of course, drinking games are near and dear to our audience. I think that there is an unofficial and certainly untrademarked Twill drinking game that would include such phrases as in someone's wheelhouse. Of course, anything Latin. Someone said loosey-goosey last week. When I said loosey-goosey, they took that as an opportunity to take a drink, so maybe I say that frequently. Friend of the show, we say all the time, brouhaha, curate. So I just gave you all of them I could think of. So hopefully you're all nice and lubricated right now, and let us know the others, and we'll curate the list of Twill drinking game terms. But until then, keep your nose out of the shot glass and continue to tune in to our show every Friday at 11 o'clock Pacific, 1900 UTC at twit.tv. You can watch us live. If you can't catch us live, you can get us on iTunes and on YouTube. The entire archive of shows is available at twit.tv/twill. Over on Facebook, we've got a page where we like to talk about the things that we're going to talk about on the show that week, tell you who our guests are going to be, get your ideas of interesting things to discuss. We do the same thing over on Google Plus and on Twitter, where I am D. Howell and Evan is Internet Cases. You can also email either of us. I'm Denise at twit.tv. He's Evan at twit.tv. And both Derek and Trevor are over on the Twitter as well. Derek, you're Derek Khanna. That's right?
Yep.
No spaces, no dots. And nope. And same thing with Trevor. Trevor Tim, all one word, over on Twitter. Of course, Trevor goes way back to when he was in law school, coming on as a guest on our show. So happy to see
been coming
you.
Coming on for years now.
Yeah, happy to see you again, as always, and happy to see you doing such a great job with EFF and the Freedom of Press Foundation, and continuing to watch all these important issues. Oh, it's our pleasure. Any final things that you want to leave our listeners and viewers with before you head out, Trevor?
Well, actually, I would just ask them to go to pressfreedomfoundation.org and check out the four organizations we're supporting this month and consider making a donation.
That's awesome. We will do that. And Derek, we're going to let you go on to your next appearance article and big advocacy issue. You've got just a schedule that makes me exhausted even to think about. But we're so thrilled that you joined us today. We're really thrilled about the great work you've been doing, and really appreciate all your thoughts and insights.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on. I think we had a great conversation, and hope some of your listeners got engaged in this issue perhaps for the first time.
Yeah, I hope so too. What do you want to leave our listeners and viewers with? Any final places they should go? The petition's now been successful, so what else should people do?
Absolutely. So I have a website in draft, which is fixcopyright.com, and my colleague in this project who created the petition, there's a website, fixthedmca.com, which is also pushing on this issue. I'm running across Capitol Hill trying to get the right bills introduced here on the unlocking issue, and you can follow me on Twitter and stay tuned for some of these bills moving forward.
We will do that. Thanks so much, you guys, for joining us. And for all of the rest of you, we hope you will tune in next week for This Week in Law. Take care.